which also was flown by his followers at demonstrations. U.S. authorities repeatedly planned to confront Sadr in 2003, leading to one of the many arguments between U.S. civilian and military leaders in Iraq. "We had a couple of operations laid down in the fall of 2003 to take him out, and they got called off by CPA very shortly before execution of the plans," said a U.S. military intelligence officer. This is just one of the many murky areas in the history of the U.S. occupation where the buck is passed with surprising frequency. Bremer states in his memoir of his time in Iraq that he wanted to arrest Sadr, but was held back by Rumsfeld and the CIA. Sadr's weekly newspaper, Al-Hawza, kept up its attacks on the U.S. occupation during the fall and winter. "Bremer follows in the footsteps of Saddam," one of its headlines charged in late February. As best as can be determined, Bremer was appalled by a rampage conducted by Sadr's militia against gypsies living in southern Iraq, and, impatient with Sanchez, took the non-military steps available to him. In late March, he used his civil authority to shut down Sadr's newspaper. A few days later, he ordered the arrest of Sadr's top deputy, Mustafa Yaqubi, who was believed by U.S. intelligence to be the brains behind the 30-year-old cleric. U.S. Special Operations troops apprehended Yaqubi in Najaf before dawn on April 3rd. Again, it isn't clear who gave them the order, and turned him over to Iraqi police. The next day, a warrant was issued for Sadr's arrest. U.S. intelligence analysts in Baghdad calculated that Sadr, cut off from his best advisor, likely would respond with riots and a few attacks, but nothing that would last long. "You think it will spike, emotionally, for 48 to 72 hours, the senior army officer said a few weeks later, alluding to an intelligence forecast of 3 to 4 days of angry demonstrations. "We didn't anticipate it would go to the level it did." During most of the U.S. occupation, there had been around 200 incidents a week aimed at U.S. and allied forces. That had increased to 300 just once, during the Ramadan offensive in early November 2003. But the occupation forces had never seen a spike like the one in the spring of 2004, about 280 incidents in the last week of March, then about 370 in the first week of April, then 600 in the second week. The U.S. intelligence analysis soon was proven dramatically off base. "I and my followers of the believers have come under attack from the occupiers, imperialism, and the appointees," Sadr said in a Friday sermon in Kufa, a town just outside the holy city of Najaf. "Be on the utmost readiness, and strike them where you meet them." What followed that battle cry grew into the most widespread fighting U.S. forces had seen since the invasion a year earlier, as Shiite fighters engaged the occupation forces for the first time. That night, gunmen killed Kufa's police chief, Colonel Saeed Tiryak. 4 Salvadoran soldiers were caught by a mob, and one was murdered when rioters placed a grenade in his mouth and pulled the pin. The next day, the police chief for Mahmoudia, a small town just south of Baghdad, was shot to death along with his driver while passing through a traffic tunnel in the capital. Witnesses said those attackers were dressed in police uniforms. Meanwhile, in Mahmoudia itself, 6 other gunmen killed another police officer. In Sadr City, the Bronx-sized slum that forms Baghdad's eastern third, a reconnaissance patrol of soldiers from the 1st Cavalry Division, which was just rotating into Iraq, ran into groups of armed fighters from Muqtadir al-Sadr's Mahdi army and was pinned down and isolated overnight. At the same time, Sadr's fighters took over all 7 police stations in the sector. 8 U.S. soldiers were killed and 51 wounded in heavy fighting before they were rescued the next morning. Several hundred Iraqi fighters were believed killed in the encounter. Like the Marines in Fallujah, army soldiers began to develop a new respect for their foe. The Mahdi army fought very courageously and demonstrated good tactical patience, waiting to engage until we were within effective range of their weapon systems, Captain John Moore wrote later in describing the fighting in Sadr City. "Once battle is joined, Mahdi army elements demonstrated incredible commitment to recover their casualties and equipment." Next to Iraq were Karbala, Basra, and Nasiriya, three of the most important cities in the south, with attacks on police stations and government offices. This was followed by a wave of kidnappings of foreigners, perceived by Iraqis to be working with the occupation. Not only Americans, but also Israelis, South Koreans, Russians, Chinese, and others. Sadr focused the firepower of his Mahdi army not on U.S. troops, but on their local allies in the police and fledgling Iraqi military. The fighting in Fallujah was fierce and surprisingly widespread, involving not just the city, but the roads leading to it. That created quiet concern about supplies. Insurgent attacks had reduced the Marines to just 2 days' worth of some critical goods. On April 7, a Marine supply convoy run by a 25-man platoon was south of Fallujah when it was surprised by a sophisticated half-mile-long ambush that began with a volley of RPG fire followed by mortar shells. Then, approximately 10 machine guns opened up from bunkered positions, according to Marine documents. The Marines, following their training, attacked into the ambush, killing 26 enemy fighters out of an estimated total of 40 to 60. One Marine was killed and six others were wounded, four severely. Marines involved in the action were awarded five of the nation's highest medals, one Navy Cross and four Silver Stars. "We'll get Fallujah under control," Abizaid vowed in an interview on April 8. But the next day, the order came down to stop. It isn't really clear where the order came from. Some Marines believed it had come from the White House. One former State Department official said on background that he thought it was ordered by Bremer, who, despite his lack of authority over military operations, was worried that the Fallujah battle was destroying support for the occupation within Iraq. So, on April 9, the first anniversary of the fall of Baghdad, the Marines found themselves implementing a unilateral ceasefire. "We were relatively close to seizing the final objectives," Colonel Tulin remembered. Mattis was furious. 39 Marines and U.S. soldiers had died. For what? "If you're going to take Vienna, take fucking Vienna," he snarled to General Abizaid, updating a famous comment made by Napoleon Bonaparte. Abizaid only nodded, Mattis recalled. Mattis believed he had the enemy on the ropes and was within a few days of finishing them off. The insurgents lacked bunkers and ammunition. They weren't able to get additional supplies through the cordon the Marines had thrown up around the city. He went out to see Tulin, operating out of a command post in Jolan, a neighborhood in northwest Fallujah. "He was very frustrated," recalled Tulin. "It was hard for him to tell me. He didn't understand why we were told to stop." For another 2 weeks, the Marines stood by, expecting to go back into the city. But then, after a series of quiet conversations among the U.S. government and its allies, word trickled down to the Marines that the White House thought that resuming the attack could shatter the coalition. Bremer told Abizaid that the Fallujah attack was threatening to fracture Iraqi support for the American presence. "If you're not confused," Mattis told Bing West on April 26, "then you don't know how complex the situation is." But the Marines had no uncertainty about their unhappiness with the outcome. As Lethen, the division operations officer, noted, "Our job was not to be emotional. Our job was to put lipstick on that pig as best we could." The end of the First Battle of Fallujah was one of the lowest points of the entire U.S. military effort in Iraq. "Most of Fallujah is returning to normal," President Bush asserted on April 28, after a series of aerial bombardments. It was a stunningly inaccurate statement. Not one of the objectives of the Marine attack had been achieved. The attack order, as stated in a Marine briefing, was to capture, kill the murderers of the coalition contractors while conducting offensive operations, to restore law and order, and build long-term stability. The desired end state, as stated in that briefing, was to make it impossible for terrorists to destabilize the city again. When the fight ended, the murderers had not been apprehended, and law and order had not been restored. What's worse, in the following weeks, it would become painfully clear that it was the murderers of the contractors who enjoyed free rein in the city, not the Marines. We turned the city over to the Fallujah Brigade, which was made up of people we'd been fighting against, said Tulin. It was a moment that would have been comic, were it not so tragic. The Fallujah Brigade was created as a fig leaf for the U.S. withdrawal. When told that the city would be controlled by this new Iraqi organization, Abizaid is said to have called Bremer and asked, "Why did you create the Fallujah Brigade?" In his memoir, Bremer reports that his own reaction to the creation of the brigade was, "What the hell is going on?" In fact, the brigade had been cooked up between the CIA and the Marines as a way of ending the political standoff over the city. The MEF, Marine Expeditionary Force, the senior Marine headquarters in Iraq, came up with the idea and floated it to CJTF, and they approved it, Lethen later said with evident regret. My opinion? That was hiring the inmates to run the asylum. It soon became clear that the members of the Fallujah Brigade had far more in common with the insurgents than they ever would with the Marines. The Iraqi officer chosen to lead the brigade, Jassim Mohammed Saleh, a former commander of a brigade of the old Republican Guard, entered Fallujah wearing the green uniform and red beret he had worn as a major general in Saddam Hussein's army. When authorities learned more about his background, Bremer's spokesman Dan Saner said much later that Saleh oversaw the slaughtering of 5,000 Shiites in Karbala in 1991. They removed him from the position. But that was just a face-saving move. The fact was that the U.S. military had stopped fighting, withdrawn from the city, and left it to the other side. General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, attempted to put a good face on this strange outcome. "I'm going to try to set the record straight," he proclaimed during a Sunday morning interview on Fox News. "The reporting to date has been, let me just say, very, very inaccurate. Here are the facts." The situation was being controlled by commanders on the ground, primarily them, not us here in Washington, he said somewhat surprisingly, given the reports from senior Marine commanders that they were ordered from the highest levels first to attack and then to unilaterally cease fire. More brazenly, he portrayed the creation of the Fallujah Brigade as just one more step in the Iraqification of security. "You know, we want Iraqis to do this work, and this is a microcosm of what we want to happen all over Iraq. The members of the brigade were Iraqis that have shown up, that want to be helpful. If they can be helpful, fine." But as was often the case in his public explanations and discussions of this war, the chairman's comments had only a loose relationship with the realities of Iraq, where there was little dispute that the outcome in Fallujah represented a setback for the U.S. cause, and most certainly wasn't something commanders wanted to replicate elsewhere. The arrangement was a stunning victory for the insurgency, charged a memo written by Nathaniel Jensen, a State Department diplomat attached to the CPA. As for the Fallujah Brigade, he added, "I strongly doubt it will work." I looked Iraqis in the eye, and they were thinking, "We can get rid of these guys," recalled a Special Forces veteran who was working on security issues. "That was the day we lost the initiative. The Iraqis realized that they could kick our ass, that they had the option to bring the fight to us." This turn of events represented a political victory for the insurgents, wrote Ahmed Hashim, an expert on the Iraqi insurgency at the U.S. Naval War College. The United States had backed down, and, more important, had negotiated with the enemy. It was also a military victory. The insurgents had fought the Americans to a standstill. "We won," agreed an Iraqi insurgent in Fallujah. It wasn't long before the Fallujah Brigade became indistinguishable from the insurgency. Wearing their old Iraqi army uniforms, some of its members, far from being helpful, began shooting at Marines based on the eastern edge of the city. The U.S. military said it considered the brigade to be disbanded. The 800 AK-47s issued to the brigade wound up in the hands of insurgents, as did some heavy machine guns and rocket-propelled grenade launchers, U.S. officers said. Fallujah, which the Marines had hoped to make a showcase for how to fight smarter and better in Iraq, instead had become an international rallying point for anti-American fighters. In June, after we had turned everything over to the Fallujah Brigade, Fallujah was like a siren calling to the insurgents, said Tulin, commander of the 7th Marines. It was like the bar in Star Wars. All summer long, he said, foreign fighters poured into the city. The fighting in the area wore on quietly for months. It reverted to the previous pattern of U.S. raids and occasional airstrikes on the one hand, and insurgent car bombs, sniper firings, and mortar attacks on the other. Both sides knew that another big battle was looming. The insurgents dug 306 fighting positions in Fallujah, many of them well-constructed bunkers rigged with explosive booby traps. There were constant probing actions, attacks, attempts to move weapons caches, Tulin recalled. By late summer, when it became clear that it would take a major battle to pacify the city, the Marines pulled back and waited for the U.S. presidential election campaign to conclude. They were determined not to fight half a battle again, and some in the military thought the next round would be so ugly that it shouldn't be waged until after the election was passed. The experiment of the Fallujah Brigade was also pronounced dead, with the Iraqi unit officially disbanded in early September. Myers, as usual, managed to portray the spring explosion as positive. At a Baghdad press conference on April 15, he called it a symptom of the success that we're having here in Iraq. With Lieutenant General Sanchez at his side, he said, "I think it's that success which is driving the current situation, because there are those extremists that don't want that success." Less than 48 hours later, the U.S. military closed long sections of two of the major highways running into Baghdad, saying the step was a necessary response to a series of attacks and bombings. Privately, U.S. commanders expressed concern about their supply lines. At one point, according to Bremer, a military officer at the CPA ordered that the Green Zone go on food rationing. The guys in Baghdad were really concerned and thought they'd have to evacuate Baghdad, recalled one general. The U.S.-led effort in Iraq stood on a tripod of three legs: U.S. forces, Iraqi forces, and international forces. As a result of the wave of violence, first the second leg and then the third leg began to crumble. "We've got a huge coalition," President Bush had insisted in March 2003. "As a matter of fact, the coalition that we've assembled today is larger than the one assembled in 1991, in terms of the number of nations participating." But the sons wasn't a solid alliance based on common interests, as the fathers had been, but rather a jerry-rigged series of deals that couldn't survive much pressure. Countries sent soldiers to Iraq as a political favor to the U.S. government, and, except for the British contingent, that good turn didn't extend to getting them into combat. One CPA official recalled sitting at a meeting in March 2004, at which first Bremer and then Sanchez chewed out the Spanish commander, who was preparing to pull out and who was making the case for cooperating with the militias. Bremer dressed him down and said, "We don't talk to militias. They're illegal," this official recalled. A few months later, after Bremer's departure, the U.S. military began not only talking to militias, but aiding and equipping some of them. Except for the Brits, they weren't there to fight, this CPA official recalled. The Dutch did good patrols on foot, the Italians only patrolled by vehicle, the Japanese didn't patrol at all. In fact, he said, under their rules of engagement, which provided only for self-defense, the Japanese weren't permitted to secure their own perimeter and had to rely on the Dutch to do it. Nor did their rules allow them to come to the aid of others under attack. The Thai battalion's rules didn't even allow them to leave their camp near Karbala, said Army Colonel Peter Mansour, because they were in Iraq for humanitarian work that under current conditions couldn't be done. In May 2004, Spain withdrew its contingent of 1,300 troops. Honduras, the Dominican Republic, and Nicaragua also pulled out their small contingents, totaling about 900 people. During that summer, the Philippines left, after a Filipino contractor in Iraq was taken hostage. Hungary left at the end of the year, and the Netherlands and Ukraine withdrew in 2005. Poland, Bulgaria, and Italy, probably the three strongest European supporters of U.S. policy in Iraq, also in 2005 announced plans to leave eventually. To a surprising degree, The Rump Coalition consisted of veterans of the Warsaw Pact. Of the 31 countries that would remain as troop-contributing nations by the fall of 2004, more than half were former communist states, and more than one-third hadn't existed as sovereign nations when the United States fought the first Gulf War. Some of the other older nations were trivial players on the global stage. Among those listed on the State Department's official internal list of coalition partners were Albania, El Salvador, and Tonga. Altogether, the troop contribution of the 31 coalition partners amounted to less than 24,000. The real coalition of the willing that was in Iraq was the one of international jihadists flocking to Iraq to fight the Americans, tartly commented Marine Colonel Hams. These are the people willing to fight. Both the Shiite uprising and the First Battle of Fallujah ended indeterminately. With Sadr, the U.S. military arrived at a negotiated solution in which he stopped his militia's attacks and U.S. forces stopped trying to kill or capture him, and a murder charge against him was ignored. Colonel Alan King was asked by his boss at CPA to write out talking points for a meeting with Sadr's deputies to arrange a ceasefire. King listed several issues for discussion, but the main one was an offer that U.S. forces would pull back from the streets of Sadr City and stay mainly on their bases near the area. That was the crux, climb down from a military confrontation, said King. His thinking was that after a stand-down, the U.S. authorities would instead try to use the tribal leaders to confront Sadr. But King was taken by surprise. Without his knowledge, his boss passed his paper to Bremer, who in turn gave it to Sanchez, who then turned it over to the commander of the 1st Armored Division, Martin Dempsey. The next day, King's phone rang. "Alan," said a voice, which King quickly recognized as that of Dempsey, under whom he had served for a period after the 3rd ID left Iraq. "Yes, sir," said King. "You motherfucker," Dempsey said, his voice intense with anger, King recalled. "If you ever tell me what to do with my division again, I will cut your fucking nuts off." Then he hung up. After that, King avoided Dempsey. But under a deal reached on May 27, both Sadr and the Americans withdrew their forces from Najaf and the nearby town of Kufa. Despite weeks of insistence by U.S. officials that his militias give up their weapons, Sadr was not required to surrender or disarm. Though the CPA would not admit this publicly, noted Larry Diamond, the former CPA official, U.S. forces later that summer would go back into Najaf and clean out the Sadr militia there. But Sadr's forces would remain in Sadr City and launch an average of more than 100 attacks a week in August and September. They also began establishing a major presence in Basra and some other southern cities. Sadr also established an alliance of sorts with former Pentagon favorite Ahmed Chalabi. Of the 6 major deputies to Sadr who had been arrested, 4 eventually were released. Meanwhile, in Fallujah, with the Marines withdrawn and the Fallujah Brigade fallen apart, the Sunni insurgents and their foreign allies were digging in. They spent months building dirt berms, sniper positions, fighting bunkers, and roadblocks. Fallujah effectively became a huge, city-sized anti-American fortress. "It was a closed city," said Captain Stephen Winslow, a Marine historian who spent much of 2004 in or around Fallujah. They owned it. That outcome deepened the ill will between some Army and Marine officers. "When the 82nd was in Fallujah and Eastern Al-Anbar in 2003-04, said General Swanick, its commander, "it operated with precision, attacking small groups. But after that," he said, "Fallujah became a quagmire because the large-scale operation conducted by the Marines had worked to alienate the population." But that assessment seems unfair. After all, Mattis had gone in with a plan to engage the population, only to be overruled and ordered to launch an aggressive attack. "Boss, we're losing," a young major told Lieutenant General Thomas Metz, one of the top U.S. generals in Iraq, after the rough month of April. Others were arriving at similar conclusions. When Colonel Paul Hughes returned home from Iraq that spring, to serve out his time until retirement in a post at the National Defense University, he decided to take a public stand on the conduct of the war. "Unless we ensure that we have coherency in our policy, we will lose strategically," he told the Washington Post. Knowing that these types of on-the-record remarks from an active-duty officer who had served in Baghdad would appear prominently in the newspaper. "I lost my brother in Vietnam," he said, in explaining his decision to go public. "I promised myself when I came on active duty that I would do everything in my power to prevent that sort of strategic loss from happening again. Here I am, 30 years later, thinking we will win every fight and lose the war because we don't understand the war we're in." One Army general predicted that the Army would start falling apart in the spring of 2005, while another one said flatly it was time for Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz to go. "I do not believe we had a clearly defined war strategy, end state, and exit strategy before we commenced our invasion," he said. "Had someone like Colin Powell been the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he would not have agreed to send troops without a clear exit strategy. The current OSD refused to listen or adhere to military advice." Was the United States in fact losing in Iraq? That was the question posed in May 2004 to Chuck Swanick, who had spent much of the previous year in western Iraq. "I think strategically, we are," he said. "I think operationally, maybe we are. But tactically, we are not." In the spring of 2004, Swanick recounted in a later interview, three things went wrong in Iraq. First, he said, was the Abu Ghraib scandal, a tactical miscue by seven or eight people that had strategic consequences. Hard on its heels was the Marine Corps siege of Fallujah, a move he argued broadly alienated the Sunni population. Third, the confrontation with Muqtadir al-Sadr similarly estranged much of the Shiite population. The United States had indeed dug itself a deep hole, and it wasn't clear that it knew how to climb out of it. When Army mine expert Paul Arcangeli returned to Iraq late in 2004, having been away since the previous summer, "It bore no resemblance to the country I was in a year earlier," he said. In the summer of 2003, he had freedom to leave the Green Zone as he pleased. "The difference between now and then is incredible," he said at the end of 2004. "They're driving 60 miles an hour through the Green Zone, combat style. It feels like they're no longer masters of their domain. They really do not rule the country." General Zinni came to a similar conclusion. "I have seen this movie," he said in April 2004. "It was called Vietnam." Chapter 16, The Price Paid. At the end of its first 12 months in Iraq, the Army began to confront the fact that it had suffered its first significant setback since the Vietnam War. The security situation had worsened, essential services were still not restored, and Iraqi faith in the American occupiers was dwindling. Some 300,000 U.S. troops had served there. The invasion force, and then the first rotation of the occupation, had gone home. The 101st Airborne, the 4th Infantry Division, the 1st Armored Division, and the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. They had been replaced by the 1st Infantry Division, the 1st Cavalry Division, the Marines, and a grab bag of National Guard and Reserve units, all thrown into missions for which those backup forces hadn't been designed. And it was increasingly clear that the units that had gone back to the United States would be coming back for a second tour. The Army had little to show for its time in Iraq since the fall of Baghdad, but 800 dead and 5,000 wounded. It was a shaken institution, losing good people and provoking others to question it as it hadn't been in decades. Special Forces troops were the leading indicators of the problem the U.S. military faced. Better educated than most soldiers and trained to be culturally sensitive, SF soldiers were among the first to speak out and criticize the approach the military was taking. Captain Oscar Estrada was typical of Army Special Forces officers in believing that the U.S. military still could prevail in Iraq, but only if it radically altered its approach. "I think we need to pull back," Estrada said. "Not pull out, but find a way to stop feeding the insurgency. Our presence there is feeding the fire. Like many others in Special Forces, he recommended revising the U.S. military presence to make it look more like the one in Afghanistan, where conventional troops are largely kept out of sight, and where the U.S. bases around the country are small facilities manned mainly by Special Forces troops. By June 2004, most Iraqis endorsed that view. In a poll conducted for the CPA in the country's biggest cities, two-thirds said they opposed the U.S. presence, but an even larger portion said the foreign troops should minimize their presence. On the question of whether the U.S. bases should be moved away from the cities, 82% agreed, and Iraqis were almost unanimous in their view that U.S. troops should stop conducting street patrols, with 94% supporting such a change. It became increasingly common for Special Forces soldiers to say that the regular army was not fighting the insurgency effectively, and perhaps was not capable of doing so. Special operators also began to argue that they were not being employed well, or even being allowed to do their jobs correctly. Lieutenant Colonel Rich Young, a Special Forces officer who served in Baghdad from March to August of 2004, said much later that the first patrol he went on was with the engineers from the 1st Cavalry Division. I asked, "What is this patrol about?" They said, "It's a presence patrol." That made little sense to Young, especially as so many patrols were being bombed in the spring and summer of 2004, resulting in casualties to U.S. troops and doing little to reassure Iraqi bystanders. "We've been through a couple of years now, and IEDs are blowing off, and the people are tired of it." The training of Iraqis, as it was structured in 2003 and early 2004, also was heavily criticized in Special Forces circles. Foreign Internal Defense, FID, is a classic Special Forces mission, but in Iraq, it was carried out mainly by contractors and members of the conventional side of the military. One of the biggest failures of Operation Iraqi Freedom will be the improper use of SF, said one Special Forces officer. He argued that SF should have been involved from the beginning in training security forces, living, working, eating, and fighting with these forces to build strong bonds, because in Iraq, like in most countries we deal with, relationships are everything. If we had done this, instead of allowing contractors and conventional forces and reserves to conduct basic training like committee training, we might be much further along. Another Special Forces officer criticized the emphasis on raids and other direct action missions, which he felt came at the expense of the training mission, and also were counterproductive. "We have become locked on killer capture as a mission statement. The killer capture charter has led to chasing bad guys and subsequently making more." Indeed, in the fall of 2003, the commander of 5th Special Forces Group, the unit specializing in Middle Eastern operations that was full of Arabic speakers, withdrew his A-teams from the Iraq countryside and consolidated them in Baghdad, where they focused almost exclusively on those direct action missions, according to an intelligence expert who disapproved of the move. "This move surrendered influence in the countryside and failed to secure Baghdad," commented Kalev Sepp, the counterinsurgency expert who later was brought in by top commanders to review their operations. The Special Forces' critique of the U.S. military approach was supported by many contractors, who, as noted, often were former SF themselves, and were more outspoken about what they saw. Dave Scholl, an Arabic-speaking veteran of the 5th Special Forces Group, became pessimistic about the prospects for the U.S. effort as he knocked around Iraq working on security for reconstruction projects. "We are the hated occupier," he wrote in a 2004 essay that circulated by email among occupation insiders. How many Iraqis have seen an American who wasn't pointing a gun at them? His radical recommendation? Draw down the U.S. military and aid presence, freeze all reconstruction, and only venture out to build something when asked to do so by a delegation of Iraqis. In Vietnam, the professional critique offered by Special Forces counterinsurgency experts was never accepted by conventional commanders. The Special Forces were the only soldiers who had the knowledge and experience to point out the answer, but the regular army absolutely wouldn't listen to them, Robert Wright, the official historian of the 25th Infantry Division, told Lieutenant Colonel Nagel, author of a study of the Army's failure to adapt during the Vietnam War, "They'd have listened to the French before they listened to their own special forces." In Iraq, the views of special forces officers ultimately would find a warmer reception. At first, theirs was clearly a minority view, disparaged as barely patriotic. But by the end of 2004, as the war dragged on, their views would gain a new respect. And by the end of 2005, they would become almost the conventional wisdom, not dominant among all commanders, but understood by many and embraced by most planners and strategists studying how to alter the U.S. military's approach. By then, even President Bush would promise in a speech at Annapolis, "We will increasingly move out of Iraqi cities, reduce the number of bases from which we operate, and conduct fewer patrols and convoys." Chapter 17, The Corrections, Spring 2004. One day early in 2004, Colonel Alan King, the civil affairs and tribal specialist at the CPA, held an unhappy meeting at a Baghdad mosque with Sheikh Harith al-Dari, the chairman of the Association of Muslim Scholars, a hard-line group with links to the Sunni insurgency. The encounter had been arranged to discuss the security situation, but the Sheikh was clearly bothered by another issue. He changed the subject and began to speak in a matter-of-fact manner about what he had been hearing of cruel, even sadistic handling of prisoners by U.S. soldiers at the Abu Ghraib prison west of the capital. King was having none of it. "I got really pissed," King later recalled. He was personally affronted by such allegations. "I said, I'm an American soldier. We don't act that way." "So," King concluded confrontationally, "if you've got pictures, documents, you show me. And if you don't," he added, "don't insult me with these false allegations." 4 months later, after the Abu Ghraib scandal broke and the images of torture and cruelty had gone around the world, King would receive a tart message from the Sheikh. "Have you seen enough pictures now?" The Bush administration offered three basic rationales for the U.S. intervention in Iraq: the threat it believed was posed by Saddam's WMD, the supposed nexus it saw between Saddam Hussein's government and transnational terrorism, and the need to liberate an oppressed people. In the spring of 2004, the first two arguments were undercut by official findings by the same government that had invaded Iraq, and the third was tarred by the revelation of the Abu Ghraib scandal. In January 2004, David Kaye, as he stepped down from his post as head of the Iraq Survey Group, the U.S. government intelligence organization created to hunt for Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, announced that he concluded that Saddam Hussein had destroyed his weapons stockpiles in the 1990s, but had tried to bluff about still having them in order to maintain an image of power. "Everyone was wrong," Kaye said. In October 2004, Charles Delfer, who succeeded Kaye as head of the ISG, produced the group's final findings. There was no such arsenal, the weapons inspector concluded in a 1,000-page report. Saddam had indeed eliminated his weapons in the early 1990s, but had tried to preserve the intellectual and physical ability to restart the weapons program at some point. Delfer also said that he had found no evidence of an effort to buy uranium from other countries. And he testified to the Senate that, as some analysts had suspected, the aluminum tubes Iraq was buying, which the Bush administration had made central to the argument that Iraq was developing a nuclear capability, were indeed for conventional military rockets. In front of the whole world, the United States government asserted that Saddam Hussein had reconstituted his nuclear weapons program, had biological weapons and mobile biological weapon production facilities, and was producing chemical weapons, the Rob Silberman Commission noted 6 months later, and not one bit of it could be confirmed when the war was over. Also in 2005, the CIA issued an internal report that amounted to a major correction of its previous conclusions on chemical weapons. Titled Iraq, No Large-Scale Chemical Warfare Effort Since Early 1990s, the report concluded that Iraq probably did not pursue chemical warfare efforts after 1991. Usually, the aftermath of intelligence errors is somewhat ambiguous. Richard Kerr, a former senior CIA official who was hired by the agency to review its pre-war analysis, told the Los Angeles Times, which was consistently solid in its coverage of intelligence issues. But the situation is rather unique, he said, because of the ability of the U.S. government to scour occupied Iraq for WMD. Ordinarily, you're never proven wrong in a clean, neat way. Meanwhile, no solid evidence of a nexus between Iraq and Islamic extremist terrorists, such as Al-Qaeda, surfaced either. In June 2004, the bipartisan 9/11 Commission, formerly known as the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, released its report, which concluded, unanimously, that while there had been contacts between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's Iraq, it had seen no evidence of a collaborative operational relationship. Instead, by the end of 2004, the U.S. intelligence community would conclude that the invasion had turned Iraq into a new breeding ground for a fresh generation of tougher, more professional Islamic extremist terrorists. With the invasion rationales of WMD and terrorism collapsing under the weight of authoritative post-war inquiries, the Bush administration began to lean more on the third leg of the rationale, liberation. Wolfowitz especially stepped up to this, in part because he always had believed it. But just as that became an emphasis, the abuses at the Abu Ghraib prison broke into public view, damaging that argument. On the evening of April 28, 2004, 60 Minutes 2, a CBS television show, revealed the extent of the abuse at Abu Ghraib and broadcast some of the memorable photographs taken of brutalities committed in the prison. 2 days later, the New Yorker magazine posted on its website an extraordinarily thorough account of abuse at Abu Ghraib by Seymour Hersh, a veteran investigative journalist. Hersh had more photos. He had transcripts of some testimony from military legal proceedings, and most important of all, he had the Army's own stunning report. Between October and December 2003, at the Abu Ghraib confinement facility, numerous incidents of sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses were inflicted on several detainees, wrote the Army Report's author, Major General Antonio Taguba. His disgust evident throughout. But it was the images that made people, even in Congress, pay attention. It was a painful moment for anyone who wore the nation's uniform or who wanted to be proud of the U.S. military. Rumsfeld later disclosed that twice during this period he had offered to step down as defense secretary. But both he and Myers, his top military advisor, appeared to have learned little from the scandal, if their public comments are any indication. In its wake, over a dozen official inquiries were conducted. One of the best of those, a review of the role played by Pentagon officials, was led by former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger. It concluded that there had been a failure not only to plan for an insurgency, but also to react to the insurgency once it erupted. It specifically faulted the assumptions that shaped the war plan. Asked about that criticism, Rumsfeld insisted in September 2004 that it was an excellent war plan, a highly successful war plan. To a surprising degree, those punished for the crimes committed at Abu Ghraib would be the lowest of the low, England, Grainer, and the like, which is to say, a low-ranking female reservist enlisted soldier and her ex-lover. The Army repeatedly insisted that its top commanders were not at fault, and seemed to refuse to consider the possibility that that stance was wrong. Even former Defense Secretary Melvin Laird, such a longtime friend of the Defense Secretary that he had helped in Rumsfeld's first campaign for Congress, found that outcome unacceptable. To stop abuses and mistakes by the rank and file, whether in the prisons or the streets, heads must roll at much higher levels than they have thus far, he wrote over a year later. The best way to keep foot soldiers honest is to make sure their commanders know that they themselves will be held responsible for any breach of honor. But that was not the message the Pentagon or the Army chose to send. Over the next year, additional information about abuses would continue to surface. There were many more Pentagon reviews, but no independent ones. And because most of the internal reviews seemed to blame the privates while excusing the generals, a lingering air of unfairness hangs over the entire affair. Also, because the top brass seemed unwilling to confront what really happened and continued to insist that each instance was an isolated case, each additional disclosure of abuse would be cited by journalists and others to challenge the theory that a few low-ranking bad apples were entirely to blame. To anyone who knew the military, that just didn't sound right. As former soldiers, we knew that you don't have this kind of pervasive attitude out there unless you've condoned it, said retired Army Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who had been Colin Powell's chief of staff at the State Department. And whether you did it explicitly or not is irrelevant. An unfortunate side effect of that continued suspicion was that it shadowed the courage shown by thousands of other U.S. soldiers. We now spend 90% of our time talking about the Abu Ghraib stuff and 1% talking about the valor of the troops, said Bing West, the chronicler of the Marines in Iraq. At the same time, the U.S. relationship with Ahmed Chalabi soured. The politician had been a longtime ally of the Pentagon and a major source of its intelligence information. As late as January 2004, he had remained in the good graces of at least part of the Bush administration and had been given a place of honor behind Mrs. Bush at that year's State of the Union address. But just 5 months later, early on the morning of May 20, 2004, Chalabi's home in Baghdad was raided. Officially, the operation was conducted by Iraqi police and was a matter for Iraqi police and the Iraqi judge who had issued a warrant. Chalabi called the raid an act of political intimidation and said that he believed that Bremer had been behind it. In fact, while the raid officially was an operation of Iraqi forces, it was actually conducted by the CIA and SEAL Team 6, said a senior U.S. intelligence official with direct access to that information. We hit his place hard because he had the records of Sunni generals that were directing the insurgency, but wouldn't turn them over, this official said. Other U.S. officials hinted darkly that there was more to the matter, and it only took a few phone calls by reporters to be told by another U.S. intelligence official that Chalabi's organization had conveyed information to the Iranian government that was considered very damaging to U.S. intelligence gathering. An American intelligence official in Baghdad had gotten drunk and told Chalabi that the Americans were routinely listening in on all his conversations and emails, the first senior intelligence official said. He said that the American eavesdroppers then caught Chalabi telling an Iranian intelligence contact, "You have to understand, the Americans are reading your traffic." Chalabi denied that allegation. "The whole thing is ridiculous," he told the Middle East Quarterly in an interview later that year. "I did not give any such information to the Iranians, and no U.S. official told me classified information." But he conceded that he had met with Iranian intelligence officials, adding that he had met with such officials from every country bordering Iraq. Chalabi also seemed nonchalant about the possibility that his organization had helped mislead the U.S. government into war, told by another interviewer that some people who had once supported the war now felt they had been suckered. He said, "Okay." Asked if he felt any discomfort with the fact that many of the arguments for justifying the invasion had crumbled, Chalabi indicated that the ends justified the means. "No," he said, "we are in Baghdad now." In his new incarnation, Chalabi began to sound like one of the Bush administration's harsher critics. "What did 14 months of occupation achieve?" he asked rhetorically in the interview with the Middle East Quarterly. "The electricity still doesn't work, thousands are dead, the United States has lost the moral high ground in the Middle East, and the UN, which opposed the liberation of Iraq, has been allowed to impose Ba'athists back on the Iraqi people." In June, President Bush was asked at a Rose Garden press conference about the Iraqi exile leader. "Chalabi? My meetings with him were very brief," the president said. "I mean, I think I met with him at the State of the Union and just kind of working through the rope line, and he might have come with a group of leaders, but I haven't had any extensive conversations with him." Asked then whether Chalabi had misled the U.S. government, Bush said, "I don't remember anyone walking into my office saying, 'Chalabi says this is the way it's going to be in Iraq.'" Then the president chuckled. Chapter 18. Turnover. Summer to Winter, 2004. On June 28, 2004, Ambassador Bremer quietly handed over official control of Iraq to Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, head of the new interim government, in a small, almost secret ceremony that lasted just 5 minutes and was shrouded from the public by the multiple layers of security still necessary to bring safety to the Green Zone. It was conducted 2 days ahead of schedule in order to keep terrorists from trying to disrupt it. A few minutes later, Bremer sent his 779th and last cable from Baghdad. Addressed to Secretary Defense, Secretary State, to White House NSC, it stated, "This is the final message to be transmitted by the Coalition Provisional Authority headquarters in Baghdad, Iraq, Baghdad 779. At a NATO summit meeting in Turkey, Condoleezza Rice passed a note to President Bush. "Mr. President," she wrote, "Iraq is sovereign." Letter was passed from Bremer at 10:26 a.m. Iraq time, Condi. Across the lower left corner of the note, Bush scrawled, "Let freedom reign." Bremer boarded a helicopter to the Baghdad airport and departed the country almost stealthily, with no public ceremony at the airport, and only a previously taped farewell address aired on Iraqi television. He climbed aboard an Air Force C-130 transport aircraft, and then, for security reasons, after his small farewell party left, transferred by helicopter to another plane. Contrary to official expectations when he landed 13 months earlier, there were still few commercial flights at the Baghdad airport, and none operated by U.S. carriers. But the occupation was hardly over. There would be more U.S. troops in Iraq at the end of 2005 than there were on the day Bremer left the country. But his departure, and that of Sanchez soon afterward, were the most positive events in a long time. The biggest shift in the U.S. effort in mid-2004 wasn't in policy, but in people. Bremer was replaced by John Negroponte, a career diplomat who had been the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The change was felt immediately, both in Washington and Baghdad. The U.S. effort suddenly felt less hapless. "As soon as we got Negroponte out there and got State involved, everything changed," said Richard Armitage, who was Deputy Secretary of State at the time. "We had reporting, it was orderly, things started to run. Under the new team, we started getting reams of reporting, so we got the texture of society, we got the debate of society, we got all of it." Also, Armitage said, Negroponte's aides set out to clean up the Green Zone. They weren't screwing in the chapel anymore. I don't know about the Blue Goose or whatever that place was, a reference to a supposed brothel in the zone, said to have been named after a Panamanian establishment notorious among U.S. Navy sailors. In a parallel improvement, Army General George Casey Jr. was tapped to replace Sanchez. Abizaid had been expected by some to play a bigger role in Iraq, but had concluded that doing so would distract him from paying sufficient attention to the rest of the region for which he was responsible. The two immediate tactical problems he faced were Iraq and Afghanistan, he told reporters. But the two broadest strategic problems that we have to deal with, that must be dealt with in a broad range, happened to be Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. So it was never an issue of getting the CENTCOM headquarters into the tactical fight. You do that at great peril to the broader mission. This is a credible argument. But it also begs the question of why Abizaid let Sanchez remain the top commander in Iraq for so long. Historians will remember Sanchez as the William Westmoreland of the Iraq War, the general who misunderstood the nature of the conflict he faced and thereby played into the enemy's hands, commented retired Army Colonel Andrew Basevich. When Sanchez took command, the insurgency had hardly begun, while a year later, when he left, Iraq was all but coming apart at the seams. This is a harsh judgment, but a fair one. Like Sanchez, Casey had commanded the 1st Armored Division. He had no combat time, but more political experience. Also, while Sanchez was a junior 3-star general, K Casey was a four-star officer, a former doctor of the Joint Staff, and Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, and so knowledgeable in political military affairs, all of which gave him more heft, both in dealing with the Pentagon and with his civilian counterparts. He soon formed a close working relationship with Negroponte, a welcome contrast to the debilitating strains subordinates had seen between Bremer and Sanchez. In the wake of the personnel changes, U.S. policy also began to shift. Most notably, the summer of 2004 saw the beginning of fundamental changes in U.S. military presence and posture. On August 5, 2004, Casey issued a campaign plan, a classified document of about 25 pages, plus a series of appendices detailing aspects of the campaign. Remarkably, this was the first time that the U.S. effort in Iraq had a roadmap for attacking the insurgency. It was no accident that the British military, which had been unhappy with Sanchez and the performance of the U.S. Army, played a major role in shaping Casey's statement, remembered an officer who was involved. Casey's campaign plan essentially called for containing the insurgent violence, building up Iraqi security forces, rebuilding economically, and reaching out to the Sunni community through both coercion and co-optation in an effort to persuade them of the inevitability of success for the U.S.-led side. Casey's office assembled a strategy shop that reported to Major General Stephen Sargent, a veteran A-10 close-attack jet pilot, who worked the military personnel system to pull in 9 of the smartest, best-educated officers in the U.S. military establishments, men who had commanded in the field and had also earned doctoral degrees at Stanford, Harvard, and MIT. Running the office was Colonel William Hicks, a veteran of special operations who was also the son of a CIA operative. These 9 officers with PhDs jokingly called themselves Doctors Without Orders, a play on the name of the French charitable organization Doctors Without Borders. But in fact, they had a very clear mandate to think innovatively about how to improve U.S. strategy in Iraq. After nearly a year of indirection and collapse in the program to train Iraqi security forces, Lieutenant General Petraeus was put in charge of it in mid-2004. Essentially, the U.S. plan was to keep a lid on Iraq until such time as newly created Iraqi forces could take over the fight. When Dave came on, there was a palpable feel of dynamism, increased pressure on us to train, recalled one Army officer, a veteran of 2003 in Iraq. Most notably, Petraeus reoriented the training of the Iraqi army. The initial thought had been to create a mechanized force at least able to deter Iran, Iraq's traditional foe. Petraeus, observing that there was an enemy already present, that is, the insurgency, focused instead on creating a lighter force able to fight it. Even so, training Iraqis was a fragile foundation on which to base U.S. operations, because they were nowhere near ready to take the lead role in putting down the insurgency. When Rand Corporation researchers visited Baghdad in the fall of 2004, they found there was a gap of 60,000 between the number of trained police claimed by the top Iraqi police officer and the number cited by U.S. officials. The key element in General Casey's campaign plan was to eliminate safe havens for insurgents before the first round of parliamentary elections in January 2005. The biggest of those was in Fallujah. The battle to retake that city started just after the U.S. presidential election in November 2004. It was a once-and-for-all attack to send a message to the rest of the cities in the Sunni Triangle. You don't have to like the Americans, but if you tolerate the presence of the insurgents, this will be your fate. Second Fallujah, as some in the U.S. government called it, was a fierce battle, but careful preparation prevented it from becoming a civilian bloodbath. While covered adequately by journalists, it probably received less attention than it should have. If a battle of this intensity had occurred during the spring 2003 invasion, reporters would have treated it like another D-Day. But by the fall of 2004, after 18 months of roadside bombings, kidnapping, suicide attacks, and lengthy battles in Samarra, Baqaba, Fallujah, Najaf, and then again in Najaf and Samarra, journalists were fatigued and probably numbed somewhat to the violence. The new battle followed months of military planning and political measures. The force assembled for the assault was more than three times the size of that in April, and included two Iraqi units. Another lesson learned from April was that the insurgents responded by attacking supply lines, so the Marines conducted a huge logistical buildup, stocking a mountain of food, ammunition, fuel, and other provisions that would enable the severed bases near the city to operate at full bore for 15 days without being resupplied. In addition to using stocks on hand, some 11 million rounds of ammunition were brought in. Also, U.S. units were dispatched to the Iraqi-Syrian border to close ports of entry to all military-aged males who might seek to reinforce the insurgents. Meanwhile, a concerted effort was made to encourage civilians to leave the city. The U.S. count was that by the time the offensive was launched, only 400 civilians remained, out of a city of perhaps 250,000. "It almost looked like the town was abandoned," remembered Colonel Michael Shoup, commander of the 1st Marine Regiment, which would play a major role in the assault. Also, the interim Iraqi government was prepared to support the attack in its public statements. On the cold, rainy day of November 8, several big 2,000-pound bombs were dropped on the railroad tracks on the northern edge of the city, signaling the beginning of the attack. Soon afterward, some 6,500 Marines, 1,500 Army soldiers, and 2,000 Iraqi troops launched an assault on Fallujah that lasted about 10 days. On top of that, there were 2,500 Navy personnel.